This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hey, it's Gemma Spegg, host of the Open Mind Original podcast, Mantra. Every Monday, I'll bring you a new mantra, a simple yet powerful phrase to help you clear your mind and stay grounded amidst the chaos. I'll also share some personal stories, journal prompts, and a weekly challenge to bring each mantra to life. Follow and listen to Mantra, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with Open Mind Studios, available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
It's the Hoffman Show, hour number two here on the team, 980, always live as well on the free Odyssey app. The Masson deal is no more for the Nationals. We'll talk to Chelsea James about it at 5:30, but right now, top story of the day, you know what it is. Deebo Samuel's coming to D.C. Let's talk about it with someone who knows Deebo quite well.
Today's top story, from the perspective of someone who's there.
You are looking live.
This just in.
Not my beat.
Joining us to discuss more on the Deebo Samuel trade, someone who's had Deebo Samuel on his beat for the entirety of Deebo's NFL career, it's our pal Nick Wagner from ESPN.com. Nick, we knew when Adam Peters made the transition from San Francisco assistant general manager to Washington general manager that there would probably eventually be some guys that would follow him. When did you think it was realistic that Deebo Samuel would be one of those guys? Did you always kind of think this may go down, knowing that Debo's kind of been one foot in, one foot out the last couple years? Or was it at some point during the season when Washington was really good, did you go, oh, no, maybe Deebo will wind up following Adam to Washington next year?
Yeah, I think there's been a couple of steps to this. But the first thing is there was always going to come a breaking point between the 49ers and Deebo, and more specifically between the 49ers and one of their top two receivers. Like, I just never got the idea from talking to people at the 49ers that they had an appetite to pay both Deebo Samuel and Brandon Ayuk near the top of the wide receiver market. It's tough to pull that off. You see the Eagles doing it, but there's not a lot of teams that are paying two receivers that amount of money. So then you kind of look at how the contracts were laid out, what happened with Brandon Ayuk last year. Obviously, there was a lot of scuttlebutt about him being traded. My understanding was the Niners always, throughout that whole process, preferred to keep Ayuk. It was just a matter of if they could find the number to make that happen. And then so last offseason, there were a lot of things that kind of pointed towards Deebo Samuel was going to be the one on his way out. Part of that was a drop-off in production, but also just the fact that they really had trouble, you know, getting away from man coverage and dealing with the man coverage that the Chiefs threw at them in the Super Bowl. That's not exactly Deebo Samuel's game. They drafted Ricky Pearsall in the first round last year. And so all those signs were kind of pointing towards a divorce coming this offseason. As far as when I thought Washington would be a player, I think when you saw the Commanders kind of take off this year, that made more sense, because I didn't get the impression that, you know, I just don't think there was a team that was going to be, you know, in the bottom of the draft or bottom of the standings that was going to be looking for a Deebo Samuel type of player. But once it became clear the Niners were going to move on from him, I think Washington was certainly at the top of my head, and especially because Terry McLaurin is the type of receiver who complements him really well, because McLaurin can do some of those things. He runs so many routes and is good at getting down the field and types of things that will open up underneath things for Deebo Samuel. So to me, it just made a lot of sense from a football perspective. And then you factor in the Adam Peters element to this, and it really made all kinds of sense.
So the production side of it is where Washington fans are like, I don't know. The production obviously dropped off. Nothing like 2021. That season is right. Like an all-time wide receiver season. That's not who he's been his entire career. It is what got him paid. Congrats to Deebo. Even if you get 2023 Deebo, I think Washington fans would be thrilled. So what happened in 2024?
Yeah, I think what you've seen is an accumulation of things. First of all, with Deebo Samuel, the thing that makes him great is also the thing that is difficult for him to deal with, because his style of play just doesn't lend itself to maximum durability. And That doesn't necessarily mean he's missing a bunch of games, because if you look at games missed over the last 3 years, there's not a lot of them. I mean, he missed some, but it's not bad. It's not like he's, you know, Cooper Kupp has missed more games than Deebo Samuel over the last 3 years by a fairly wide margin. But it's the nicks and the bruises, the things that slow him down. Even just this past year, he had multiple things that happened, including an illness in which he had pneumonia symptoms and missed a big chunk of a game that it looked like he was going to play. He was active, and then he tried to give it a go, and within a few plays, it just wasn't going to work out. So I think that is part of it, certainly the injury standpoint with Deebo Samuel, because of his playing style, his kind of fearless take on anybody, the style that makes it difficult for him to stay healthy. So there was some of that. I also think this year, you know, it's easy to kind of go back and change history. But going into training camp, Deebo Samuel was in great shape. He had a really good training camp, and there was a lot going on out here during camp last year with Trent Williams, with Brandon Ayuk. There were so many different things that were happening. And Deebo was like the one reliable star who was on the practice field every day and producing, had a really good camp. And I thought he was in line for a really big season, also because he was kind of in a de facto contract year. Not exactly a contract year, but essentially one. And so it really seemed like everything was lining up for him to have that kind of year. It just didn't happen. As the year went on, I don't think he was in as good a shape as he came in with. Some of that was because of the injuries, and maybe it made it harder for him to stay in shape. But that has been something that people have kept an eye on throughout his career here. And then I also think there's just an element of there's so many mouths to feed here between Ayuk and Kittle and McCaffrey. And I know they were missing some of those guys this year, but Juwan Jennings had a breakthrough year. It just made it more difficult for Deebo to produce. So I do think this is a player who's probably more on the downturn, but I also think, to your point, it wouldn't be outrageous for him to get back to something like that 2023 level, which I'm sure the Commanders would be more than happy to take.
Nick Wagner, ESPN.com, with us here on the Hoffman Show, talking Deebo Samuel. The biggest number that dropped off to me, or like the most concerning number, is the rushing yardage. He went from about over six a carry for three straight years to three a carry last year. What was up with that? And I know the 49ers offense as a whole struggled running the football last year. So there's certainly a lot of factors that could go into it. You watched it all. What were the ones that stuck out to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think first and foremost, at some point with Deebo Samuel, the element of surprise is gone. So, you know, when the Niners sprung that on everyone in the 2021 season, it was out of necessity. Raheem Mostert was injured. Elijah Mitchell was getting banged up. And so Deebo was kind of just like a last resort. And it worked so well that it became kind of a staple of their offense. And so I think as the years have gone on, and also you ran into in the ensuing 2 years, where they had Christian McCaffrey, they had George Kittle, they had Brandon Ayuk, Juwan Jennings, they had all these guys where, yeah, even if Deebo was, you knew Deebo was going to get the ball, it was a lot harder to stop. So last year, I think you saw a combination of things. One, a lot of those guys were missing. So everyone's eyes were on Deebo Samuel. When you put him in the backfield, everyone was expecting it and stopping it pretty easily, actually. And like you said, there were also issues running the ball, and those were blocking issues in some instances as well. The other thing is Deebo Samuel just, quite frankly, did not do as good a job as he has in the past of breaking tackles. And again, I think that is a play style that is the thing that made him great, but it's very hard to sustain that ability for a long period of time because you take so much of a pounding from the many hits that you take. Even if you're breaking tackles, you're still taking punishment. So I think it was a combination of those things. And even if you look at Deebo Samuel as a receiver last year, wasn't breaking as many tackles when he wasn't in the run box and wasn't confined to space that way. So there was a little bit of a drop off in that regard. I still think, Craig, that there is ways that Deebo Samuel can be used in the run game, that he can be effective. I just think that the days of him being able to line up in the backfield, taking a handoff and ripping off 6 yards to carry are probably gone. That, again, that doesn't mean you can't use him with jet sweeps, orbit motion, those types of things, where you can get the ball in his hands in an easier way than throwing it downfield.
For sure, and those are all staples of the Washington offense with Kliff, and so are some of like the slammer screens and all those kinds of things that Debo's been amazing at, and the Commanders last year. Like, De'Ami Brown did a good job of those, but he ain't Deebo Samuel. as far as the off the field slash on the field, off the field stuff, that is the other area where I think fans have questions. We saw the incident on the sideline last year where he's yelling at Jake Moody and then slaps the long snapper. There's been all the contract talk in the off season. And I, for me personally, Nick, I'm guessing like you, as someone who covers the league, like these are things that happen. They are not ideal. There are guys that take care of their contract stuff more quietly than Debo did. That is probably more ideal if we're talking about it from a fan slash organizational perspective. But we also know that character and kind of the guys that the brotherhood and how they came together was a huge part of this Washington season. So what do we make of some of Debo's, I'm going to call it off the field, but I'm just saying that as a way to categorize things, not in an indicting way. What do we make of the off the field stuff?
Yeah, I think it's revisionist history for people to pretend like Debo was some sort of a cancer or a problem in the locker room. I don't think that. I don't feel that. Now, were there things that annoyed people? Sure. And you mentioned the incident with the kicker and the long snapper and things like that. The thing about Debo is Debo's an emotional player, and I think other guys actually feed off of that more than anything. And I think if you talk to a lot of his teammates here, they all loved him because he was that guy who would. He wasn't afraid to say whatever was on his mind, but more often than not, Craig, he went out and backed it up. And I think if you go back to the Super Bowl, the last Super Bowl season, and they lost to the Chiefs, there's the Philadelphia situation. If you remember that, you know, they played the Eagles in the NFC Championship game. Brock Purdy gets hurt early on, and that whole offseason, anytime Debo Samuel was asked about it, he's like, I think we would have won that game. He made it very clear he thought he was going to have a big game, that the Niners would have won that game if Brock Purdy hadn't gotten hurt, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, Eagles fans didn't like that, and then the following season, they played the Eagles in December. Debo Samuel, that week leading up to that game, spoke his mind. He stood by everything he said, went to the game dressed in all black for what he would later say was the Eagles' funeral, and then put up over 150 yards and 3 touchdowns in the game. So I say all that to say that I think that there is certainly he could rub people the wrong way, but I also think that teammates really appreciate the fact that he is willing to set a tone. And I could tell you, as someone who has covered these guys and knows them pretty well, Trent Williams and Debo Samuel are really close friends. And I wrote a story about this a couple years ago, and I was talking to Trent Williams about what it is, you know, why he and Debo kind of, were close and why they were such good friends. And Trent Williams told me that one of the things that he learned from Debo, who, mind you, is quite a bit younger than Trent, was that it's okay to have a little swag. It's okay to say that you're the best, to speak that into existence, which is a crazy thing to hear from Trent Williams because everybody knows he's one of the best tackles in the league. But Debo's kind of openness about his own standing in the league made Trent more confident that he could put himself out there in a similar way. So I say all that again because I think that Debo is largely been a positive influence and a tone setter for a very successful era of 49ers football that, yes, it didn't end in a Lombardi trophy like they would like to, but I think it has been obviously very successful on the aggregate, and I think that Debo Samuel has been a big part of that.
Nick Wagner, ESPN.com, with us for just another couple of minutes here on The Hoffman Show. That's so interesting to hear that about Trent, because I covered Trent here when I was still on the beat, and he was obviously the best player on the team. And there was always like it's not quite humility. Like, it is humility, but there's kind of like a, I know I'm the best, but please don't make me say it kind of thing about him. Right. Like, he just kind of gave you that smirk. And I love that for Trent, that he now is just like, nope, I'm the best, because he is. And it's just so inarguable in terms of what he's been for the last decade in terms of left tackle play in the NFL. All right. Last things for you, Nick. I want to ask you about two non-Debo guys that are also on Commanders fans' radars, free agents for San Francisco. Mm-hmm. One is one of the top corners on the market, Charvarius Ward. What do you think who is he as a player? And do you think the Niners will bring him back, or is he someone that's going to get paid and go somewhere else? And, you know, Washington could certainly be in the market for another corner opposite of Marshawn Lattimore.
Yeah, Charvarius Ward's market is going to be fascinating, because if he had hit the market after the 2023 season, he probably was in line for a 20-plus million dollar a year deal. And then last year happened, and so much of what happened, and he would tell you it was one of his worst years, but it was one of his worst years off the field. Like, he went through so much, and for people who don't know, his young daughter died kind of suddenly after some heart problems. She was about almost 2 years old, and that happened during the bye week, and it just, as you would imagine for any human being, it threw his whole world kind of into flux for the rest of the season. And so he did come back and he tried to play through it, but as you can imagine, he was distracted for much of that time, kind of spoke openly about it at the end of the year. Terrier's Ward is still a really good player, I believe. I think he's got a lot of good football still left in him, even though I think he's approaching 30 at this point. I just don't know how teams are going to value him. I will say, the chances of him coming back to the 49ers, you know, speaking with him at the end of the year, I didn't get the impression that was going to be likely, and mainly because, as he said, he has a lot of trauma in California. Like, coming back here makes him think about his, you know, his young daughter, and I think a fresh start kind of situation is something that maybe he is looking for. But again, I don't know what the market would command for him. He's a bigger corner, physical corner, good press corner, can play zone or man. Very confident guy, had a really tremendous year in 2023, and a good locker room guy. I know his teammates loved him. So if he is in that, you know, kind of $13, $14 million a year range, that would certainly be more than the Niners could afford, even if coming back here was realistic. But I don't know. I just don't know, frankly, what his market is going to be, because, you know, how much do teams say, like, yeah, we understand that you went through a lot last year, we're still going to pay you, or not? I don't have that answer.
Yeah. And, you know, who knows? Like, your life has changed forever when something like that happens. So I hope wherever he goes that he's happy, man. That is so brutal. Last guy I want to ask you about, I think Commander's priority at safety is probably to re-sign Jeremy Chinn, but who knows what happens when he hits the market. And obviously, it's easy to connect the dots to Talanoa Hufanga, who Adam Peters played a huge role in drafting out in San Francisco, a guy that probably 2 years ago, Nick, you're like, this guy's, I'm going to be covering him for a decade. Like, he's going to be a Niner for life, the level he was playing at. A couple of injury plagued seasons later, he's now going to hit the free agent market. What kind of player still is he, and what do you think he ultimately where do you think he ultimately lands?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of put him in, and Dre Greenlaw, who's the linebacker that the Niners have, was a free agent also. I kind of put those guys in the same bucket where it's really hard to get a read on what their market is going to be, because both guys are really good players when they're healthy. Greenlaw in particular, I think, is an outstanding player who probably doesn't get enough credit when he's healthy, but they're not, they haven't been healthy enough. And so how do teams value them? Probably, I would say, for me, you know, 1 year kind of prove it deals. Can you stay healthy for a year? And then next year, maybe you cash in. But as you know, Craig, it just takes one team to say, well, we'll give you a 3 year deal or whatever. And, you know, we'll build in some incentives and we'll make it a little bit more lucrative than a 1 year deal with. And maybe they would take that because, you know, just to give you an example, Greenlaw, when he signed his most recent deal with the 49ers, I remember asking him, like, why did he sign it during the season? I said, well, you know, why now, Dre? Like, why didn't you want to test the market? Like, you probably could have gone out and got life-changing money, which I guess it's all life-changing money, but you know what I mean?
Right.
There's levels to this. And he said, well, he said, I've had some injuries and stuff. I want to get some security for my family. So he signed a two-year deal that was certainly below the market of what a guy like him would have commanded if he had become free. So I say that because I think both of these guys are in a similar situation where they probably would like some more security, and maybe they could be had below market but above a one-year prove-it deal, if that makes sense, kind of in a happy medium between those types of things. So as for Hufanga, you know, he didn't have quite as many, you know, just debilitating injuries as Greenlaw. You know, he's not coming off an Achilles. He was coming off of an ACL from the previous year. And then he dealt with a wrist thing, which I didn't think was a huge deal, but he played pretty well toward the end of the year. I think with Hufanga, what you get is a guy who's very instinctive and he can make big splash plays. But he's also someone who's a little bit prone to giving up those big plays when he's wrong. And so that's kind of the fire that you play with a guy like him, but certainly a great leader, a guy who is, you know, well respected in the locker room. And I think certainly would be there if he was to land there. So I don't know what kind of price you're getting with him, but again, that might be someone who you could get at a relative bargain and see where it goes.
Maybe the free agent market's always been this crazy and I haven't had to pay as much attention to it because Washington stunk most of the time that I've covered them, but it does feel this year like it's all over the place for so many players. Really unique market. It's going to be fun to follow over the next couple of weeks. But speaking of which, just like 30 seconds here, this isn't the main point of our call, but I am curious, like, the Niners are supposed to be good. Like, they still want to compete. Like, where do the Niners see themselves as, you know, potential competition for Washington and Philadelphia and Detroit and the teams at the top of the NFC going into 2025?
I think they're in a little bit of a crossroads right now because they want to be competitive. They want to be competitive every year, and they certainly would like to be Super Bowl competitors this year, if for no other reason than the Super Bowl will be played in their home stadium. But I also think they're in a little bit of a spot, and they won't use the word rebuild, but I think maybe a reset. And the Deebo Samuel is a good example of telling you that they're open to this because they're eating $31-plus million in dead money. And I think they need to get younger. They know they need to get younger. And they also need to find a way to start kind of clearing their books. So the fact that they're eating that much dead money, I think they're over $60 million in dead money this year, tells you that they're in a little bit of a reset from where they're at contract-wise and in terms of who their core is going to be moving forward. Because they're going to sign Brock Purdy to an extension most likely at some point here this offseason. George Kittle will probably get an extension, but I think they're going to be a little bit more selective about who they're building around and who they are right now. So, yes, they want to be competitive. Are they on a Washington or a Philadelphia level? That remains to be seen because they've got a lot of work to do, particularly when it comes to rebuilding both of their lines. Right?
Just use the word recalibrate, Nick. It'll send you right to the NFC Championship game. That's what we did here. No rebuild.
It's funny you say that because John Lynch used that word did multiple really? Times.
So. I'm sure he did. I'm sure he did. Nick, this is great as always. Really appreciate you, man. It's been great reading your coverage of this as it's been building up and then to have you on the show here to finish it off. Nick Wagner, everybody, ESPN.com. You can check out the story that he and John Keim wrote on the Deebo trade and much, much more. Nick, thanks, dude.
You got it, Craig. Take care. See ya.
ESPN.com's Nick Wagner. When we get back, the Washington Post's Chelsea Janes on the Masson deal finally coming to an end for the Nats. It's the Hoffman Show. We're on the Team 980, always live as well on the Free Odyssey app, streaming live on YouTube too at the Team 980. Thanks again to Nick Wagner, who just joined us from ESPN.com on the Deebo Samuel trade. We'll get back to Deebo and the rest of the news around the NFL. There's a ton of it coming up at 6 o'clock. But right now, it's our pleasure to welcome back to the show someone we've been welcoming on for years and years and years, Chelsea Janes. She covered the Nationals. Now she's covering baseball nationally for the Washington Post. And today, the Nationals, and to some extent, I guess, the Orioles are in the news because our long national nightmare, perhaps more accurately, Chelsea, our long regional nightmare is over. The Masson deal that has held the Nationals hostage, according to, well, the Nationals, is finally no more. The Nationals will have their own TV rights to sell in 2026. Just on a purely personal level, Chelsea, how excited are you that this is the last time we are ever going to talk about this part of this story?
Oh, thank you for asking. It's huge. And I know a lot of people at the Nationals feel the same way. It's a very happy day for everyone, for sure.
I am sure down the street here at Nationals Park, they are absolutely thrilled about this. So what happened here? We know this has been in the courts. There's been this years-long dispute over the value of these TV rights. They, of course, were granted to the Orioles and Masson back when the Nationals came into existence in D.C. because of the proximity. The Orioles were like, well, we need something. If there's going to be another team, we're going to lose part of our fan base, the whole deal. That's how it all started. How did it end?
You know, we're still trying to kind of figure out what exactly spurred the end, but I think obviously a change in Orioles ownership was the prerequisite. You know, Peter Angelos and his family were very, you know, staunchly against giving anything back to the Nationals. They didn't want them here in the first place. They certainly weren't going to concede. But when David Rubenstein took over, he was pretty clear that, like, look, you know, with cord cutting being what it is, cable rights aren't worth what they used to be. I'm going to spend more in the courts than I am, you know, fighting this than I am just kind of getting it over with. And he seemed more amenable to getting it done, and clearly that's what happened. You know, the Nats are going to get a pretty significant portion of the money they were owed, you know, for the last few years. And they're going to get to sell their rights on the open market next year, which, even if it doesn't yield more money than the Masson deal did, just gives them a flexibility and a certainty that they haven't had in years.
Now, for a long time, Chelsea, this was seen as one of the holdups in the Lerner's selling the team. This announcement also comes, what are we, less than a month after the Lerner's say, we're actually not going to sell the team. We're taking it off the market. Is that decision final? Like, what, do you think that has anything to do with the timing here that the Lerner's committed to continuing to own the club?
You know, I don't think the decision not to sell is final. I think if someone came to them with an offer they were happy with, they would take it. And I think this increases the chances that they get one of those, whether it's from Ted Leonsis, who has always wanted a baseball team. At least he's always wanted the rights to broadcast the baseball team on Monumental. You know, I don't know if that leads directly to a sale or just to a sale of the TV rights, but whatever it does, it just makes everything easier. You know, if the learners, you know, look at this and say, okay, we've got a more certain revenue stream on TV now, we keep the team, it makes that easier. If they want to sell, it makes that easier. So I don't quite know which track they're going to take. I don't know that, you know, anyone does. You know, I think that might still be something they're kind of figuring out themselves, but whatever it is, everything has just gotten so much easier, and the future, I think, therefore, has gotten a little bit brighter.
Chelsea Janes, national reporter, national baseball reporter for the Washington Post, with us here on the Hoffman Show. We'll get to the baseball impact on this, which your colleague, our friend Barry Sferluga, wrote about in just a minute. But in terms of the options of where the Nationals go, this will be their last year on Masson, probably, I guess. I guess they could theoretically turn around and resell the rights to Masson, although that feels a little bit silly. What are the options here? Not only just looking at Monumental as the regional sports network here, but some of the other things that Major League Baseball is trying to do it, and some other models that teams are using, even going back to like linear television.
Yeah, you know, I think what we're looking at probably is the easiest solution, which is probably Ted Leonsis and Monumental adding, you know, the Nationals to their portfolio and, you know, streaming them that way. But there is a lot going on right now. And I know, you know, Rob Manfred really wants to get as many teams' rights streaming wise as he possibly can. So will he encourage the Nats not to sell those? Maybe. Will they listen? Who knows? But, you know, it's just kind of an interesting time. And I think, you know, regardless, you know, Monumental probably won't be the only people interested in trying to get these rights. I don't know who else might be. It's early to say, but you know, there's a bidder now. So whatever it is, I think, you know, the Nats are just going to be happy to be in control of it, to kind of know that the money they agree to is coming in. And whether that's a part of some bigger MLB package or not, I think it's just really good for them. And also, you know, something that's going to be interesting to watch play out, because now they'll kind of be able to look at the Orioles and say, what are they getting, and vice versa. So that'll be kind of fascinating.
Can you explain to the audience who may not be as locked in on this what Manfred is trying to do on the national level, and where this kind of two-year timeline of the next 2 years of rights for every team that may be up, and how that's affecting that?
Yeah, so I think for years, you know, Rob Manfred, the commissioner of MLB, has wanted to get the rights to stream all 30 teams in one place and sell that and say, you pay this, you know, we take all the revenue, and, you know, you get whatever team you want. No blackouts like we know there are now with MLB TV. None of that. The barrier to that has been these cable deals, wherein many teams have committed to have their, you know, games broadcast over, you know, cable systems, and have either not had access to their own streaming rights or have committed those streaming rights to the cable system. So it's not under their control. But as a, you know, cord cutting has diminished the value of many of those deals and even forced, you know, the people that bought the rights to buy these teams to go bankrupt, which has happened for a lot of teams. Everybody's kind of hit the open market. A lot of small market teams have started from scratch. They don't have those deals anymore. So Manfred says, hey, like, give us your rights. You know, we'll package them up and we'll try to get them out as part of something bigger than MLB. Don't sign some long-term deal that locks you in. You know, we want to see what we can get. Unfortunately, the big teams, the Dodgers, the Yankees, the Cubs, the Red Sox, they've all got these massive cable deals. They've got networks that have their own streaming apps, so they're making tons of money. So they don't really have incentive to kind of join this group package that Manfred wants to create. But for a team like the Nationals, they're kind of right on that bubble. You know, can they get more on their own? You know, will he be able to kind of talk them into waiting? That's you know, what we've all seen. But the collective bargaining agreement is up in 2026. You know, MLB is in the process of negotiating a new national rights deal with ESPN after kind of ending their most recent one. So it just could go a lot of different ways right now. And, you know, I think the Nationals are more in control of their rights than ever in a market that is very unpredictable. But I think if he had his way, Manfred would have their rights and everybody else's, and throw it out to the fans and say, pay this much for streaming and we'll take all the money and it'll be that easy.
And so it would look something like what MLS has with Apple TV, which most MLS fans hate. So right on par.
Right.
For Leonsis, like, what is this worth to him? And is this like, I guess you kind of touched on this. I just kind of want to unpack it. Like, him buying the TV rights versus him buying the team. Do you think he's interested in just the TV rights, even if he does not own the Washington Nationals?
I certainly think he's interested in the TV rights, but he's also said he's interested in the team. Now, whether he was only interested in the team because he wanted the TV rights, I don't know. And I think we're all going to find that out. But, you know, he's got the WNBA, he's got hockey, he's got the NBA on his network. What's lacking there? Summer programming. You know, I mean, like, the WNBA is there, but, you know, if you have baseball, you've got stuff that kind of bridges the gap between all those things. You've got all the major sports other than the Commanders in D.C. It's sort of a, yeah, I think that's kind of what his goal has been this whole time. So certainly I would expect him to be interested in the TV rights to the Nationals. Whether he, you know, now feels kind of more equipped to buy the team because he knows that he would have those rights, I don't know. But I certainly think that this had to happen before, you know, that could even come into play. You know, they weren't going to sell it to him with those rights not included. And, you know, here they are. They either can negotiate a deal for the rights, the team, both, whatever. But I would expect that to be the direction it goes, or at least starts, you know, as the learners kind of recalibrate with this news.
Yeah, it's so funny the way that you phrase that, right? Does he want the TV rights because he wants the team, or does he want the team because he wants the TV rights?
Right,
and
right.
With Ted, I don't know. And I don't, I'm sure he knows, but I don't think the rest of us do. If you want more of this, and if I didn't ask the question that you want of Chelsea, her, Barry's Fraluga, and Ben Strauss, the Post media writer, will be hosting a chat at 11 a.m. tomorrow on WashingtonPost.com/sports. You can check that out. Chelsea, always appreciate your time here on the radio, ma'am, and I'm sure we'll talk to you as we get closer to baseball season.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Chelsea Janes, everybody, with us here on The Hoffman Show. When we get back, it's not our weekend preview, Anthony, because the weekend is over. It's our weekend review. Also brought to you by...
Nobody, Craig.
Here's what's trending. It's The Hoffman Show. We're on the Team 980, always live as well on the free Odyssey app. Streaming live on YouTube, too, at the Team 980. Anthony, before we get into our weekend in review, I gotta say, your green jacket, very like Eagles Kelly green, and it looks good on you, which I don't mean to draw those two things together and be like, oh, I'm trying to cause trouble for you. But last week during the combine, I wore a green shirt and I got a couple YouTube comments about it.
Ooh.
And people are like, how can you, I love your content, how can you wear an Eagles green shirt? And my answer was simple. I said, my wife thinks I look great in green. I think she's right. I think it's a color that works for me. So, Anthony, I think you look great in your green, sir.
Thank you, sir. But also, to everybody that does have something to say about my green, how long until I can wear green?
That's kind of the thing. It's like, would I wear a green shirt on Eagles week? No.
No. But no, the season, no. You know, we lost about a month and a half ago.
It wasn't a month and a half ago. It was only like a month ago. Month and a week ago?
Oh, yeah, because it is. Yeah, the third. Yeah, month and a week. 5 weeks.
Yeah.
It's been 5 weeks, guys. Let it go. New season. Yeah. I mean, I guess the new league season hasn't started just
But still,
yet.
Like, why are you trying to step on my man's game?
Yeah. Hey, look. I look good in this green, sir.
That's what I'm saying.
Thank you, sir.
Figured I would throw that out there for you.
Thank you.
Felt like I was getting you in trouble for a second, but it's helping you out.
Yes, you were.
Holler at your boy. All right. The weekend in review is brought to you by
Nobody, Craig.
Yep, but we're going to do it anyway. Fun weekend all around the sports world. Of course, the combine was one of the biggest things. We'll talk about that more as we go in the 6 o'clock hour. How about the Zardos over the weekend? We'll talk to Dave at 6:30 about them, more specifically to what they are up against tonight. And by the way, Justin Champagne is going to be on the show tomorrow. Champagne agreeing over the weekend to a 4-year, $10 million deal. According to ESPN, on the terms, the Wizards officially announced the 4-year deal today. He's having a career year. And the old Zardos, after losing to the Trailblazers on Friday night, beat the Hornets. And, Anthony, they have swept the Hornets this year.
We swept them?
I do believe they have swept the Charlotte Hornets.
I mean, they are the second worst team, so I guess it sort of kind of makes sense, but it's still shocking that we swept.
I guess this is just a good matchup. Yeah. Chris Middleton continues to just be a professional athlete. 17 points, 5-9 shooting, nice and efficient, 6 assists. Did have 4 turnovers in that win over Charlotte. But defensively, like, Wizards are actually playing some good defense as of late. Like, not every night, of course. I mean, look, they're still them. They're young. And when I say they're still them, like, one, they're not really trying to win games in large amounts. Two, they're a young team, and you're going to have nights that go sideways. But, like, they gave up 100 to the Hornets. They gave up 129 to Portland. Shaden Sharp, by the way, in that game. Oh, my God. That Lord. Dunk that he had. Whew, oh, my. Moment of silence. Wow. Against the Nets, they gave up 99. It was a 104-101 game against Milwaukee. So, like, in the last, when was this Milwaukee game? This was on, oh, come on, give me a date, game information.
I was February, there too.
February 21st.
Yep.
So, since basically the All-Star break, since they came back, they've almost every other night been, like, pretty good defensively. So, that's an exciting thing, I think, for this team moving forward. And obviously, getting Marcus Smart in there is kind of helpful on that front. College hoops over the weekend, Anthony. What caught your eye in the college basketball world over the weekend? Anything in particular jump out at you?
The Alabama versus Tennessee game was crazy. Mm. Crazy. Down to the wire. I don't know the kid's name from Tennessee, but all I know is like 4 seconds on the clock, he gets the inbound, takes like 3 dribbles, pulls up maybe a step or two in front of half court, cash. They win in a thriller.
We shouldn't talk too much about buzzer beaters, though, the way things went for Maryland last week.
I know that one did hurt. You know, their last 3 losses have been like that.
I know.
Which is insane. Like, God dang. Can't
Gotta
catch a break.
Close a game, Turtles. Come on.
And then the USC-UCLA game. I didn't get to watch it, but I did see USC swept the UCLA women, which was crazy.
Yeah. On the men's side, you also had, where did it go? Auburn pretty much just crushes Kentucky. Auburn rolling the number one team in the country, 94-78 on Saturday. Sunday on the men's side, Michigan State toughs it out against Wisconsin, 71-62. That was an 8 versus 11 matchup. And then Michigan goes down hard by 20, 93-73 at home by Illinois. Good gracious. This tournament should actually be a lot of fun this year. On the women's side, like you said, the big one of the weekend was that USC beat UCLA. UCLA was the last undefeated, if I'm remembering correctly, on the season.
Yep.
And now USC's beaten them twice. USC up to number 2 in the coaches poll today. Juju Watkins, 30 points, 3 blocks. She is, I mean, on top of what she does offensively, we're like, she's one of these players, you know, like certain guys you watch in the NBA and certain players you watch in the W, you're like, that wasn't a great shot, but it went in all the time.
Yep.
They're just, it's not a bad shot maker. It's just like, what's a good shot to them is such a wider bucket, no pun intended, than everybody else on the floor. That's Juju.
Yeah.
And then she's 6 feet tall and super athletic and super long, and she's blocking people left and right.
Yeah.
She is a menace.
I'm excited for what is to come, but to your point, yeah, I think she does take a lot of, in our eyes, bad shots, but it's sort of kind of like Carmelo Anthony. I don't think he took a lot of good shots. Like, there wasn't one shot that he's seen that he didn't like, for real. So I think that's more so like where she, you know, gets her, like, confidence from. Like, she's getting to her spots, she's making them, and you can't really complain.
She doesn't see, you know, Kyrie once was quoted as basically saying, I don't see defenders, I see cones. Because he practices moves as if there's defenders in front of him with cones of like, I got to get to this spot. And I feel like Juju's one of those players for sure. On Sunday, a lot of action around the women's college game. Notre Dame continues to roll. They smack Louisville 72-59. Texas, number one team in the country right now, 72-46. And South Carolina, they beat Kentucky 78-66, which means that both teams finish 15-1 in the SEC, which means, Anthony, they're tied, which means, you know how we decide a winner in terms of the SEC and the number one seed in the SEC tournament?
A coin flip.
A coin flip. A coin flip that went South Carolina's way.
Yeah.
which I think is justice. Here's why.
Yeah, tell me why.
I think a coin flip is stupid. And I have a better idea that at first you're going to think sounds crazy. I think you should base it off last year's record.
Huh?
Why should, like, I realize, especially in college, things are year to year. Right? Year ends, you crown a champion, it means absolutely nothing for you in the next year. Outside of, I guess, the polls, right? But in terms of, like, your conference, what it means you get to hang a banner and you get a trophy. Why can't we make it mean more? Why can't, if there you run out of tiebreakers, but somewhere before coin flip, and if you want to do point differential in the conference, or you want to come up with something else that's in season, that's fine. But try convincing me that a coin flip makes more sense than where the two teams finished in the conference last year. And I realized this one would have been a little complicated because Texas wasn't actually in the SEC last year.
Oh.
But, like, South Carolina was the reigning champion. Nobody knocked him off. Why did this come down to a coin flip? At first, you think it's a bad idea, but try telling me that makes less sense than a coin flip.
Yeah. That's tough then. I don't know. But my thing also is, though, Craig, since it's these two teams and they both have the same record, why not just do head-to-head?
Didn't they split? Is each of their one loss, is South Carolina's one loss to Texas and Texas lost to somebody else? I thought they split.
Oh, I didn't know.
Because if it is, if they did play once, and head-to-head should be it. Yeah. That should always be the number one tiebreaker. You played, who won? Okay, cool. You can't do overall record because schedules aren't even, yeah. Right? You want teams to take it easy in the non-conference. You want good games, right? So why not just use, if you want to do point differential, again, that's fine. If you want to do home record or away record, like if one team lost at home, like at 15-1 and your one loss came at home, the other ones came on the road, sure, I can make an argument for that. But I think that making the continuity of the program a factor is definitively more sensical than a coin flip. That's all I'm saying. A coin flip, why has it got to be a coin flip? Why can't we play rock, paper, scissors? Each team captain or each coach. What if we got Don out there playing rock, paper, scissors?
Or the coach is playing one-on-one?
Sure. Makes more sense than a coin flip.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, and to your point, they did split, yeah.
Anything else that... Anything else that happened this weekend that we want to...
Oh, the last thing, Craig, and you probably didn't watch it, but Gervonta Tank Davis fought Lamar.
Oh, yeah.
There's been a lot of arguing on Twitter about, you know, DC's own Lamont Roach getting robbed in that fight. And I'm not going to lie, Craig, a lot of the people on Twitter, they have points. There are points to be made for why Lamont Roach really should have won, but it ultimately ended up ending in a draw. And I'm excited for a rematch. I hope it's sooner rather than later. That is what I will say. Good Saturday night of boxing, though.
One that was taken in person by Deebo Samuel.
Yes, he was there.
He was there. Jaden, by the way, was at the USC-UCLA game and then went to the Lakers game that night as well. So nice little hoops night in L.A. For Jaden Daniels. That game, by the way, was sold out. One of my friends tried to go, and I was like, oh, that's sick. You're in line. And she's like, no, it's not sick. It's sold out. Like, oh, okay. All right, then. It's the Hoffman Show. We're on the Team 980. That's your weekend in review, brought to you by...
Nobody, Craig.
Coming up next, we are going to go around the NFL. Tons of news over the weekend. We'll get to everything non-Deebo, and then we'll take a few more of your calls on Deebo at 6:15 before Dave Johnson joins us at 6:30.